This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Now, I don't think there's a keener observer of American politics and life than Barry Blitt. Now, forgive me for bragging a little bit when I say this, because Barry's been one of the great cover artists for The New Yorker for a very long time. By way of introduction, I'm going to read you the blurb for his new book, which is called, pretty logically, Blitt. Here's how it goes. Quote, a gorgeous, hilarious, and provocative compendium of the award-winning artist's illustrations for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Vanity Fair, etc., and so forth. Now, I'm quoting. This is directly from his website. It continues, quote, Barry Blitt's cartoons have been lampooning American politics and culture, blah, 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 etc. This lavish full-color collection showcases more than a quarter century of etc. And so on and so forth. You get the idea. The less said about it, the better. End quote. Barry, tell me about this book, the decision to do a book now. What is it... You know, you've done other books before, obviously. What's this book about, in a sense? Blitt by Barry Blitt. Good title, by the way.
Do you think so?
I think it's excellent.
I was going to call it In One Eye and Out the Other. And then it seemed pretentious, and I just, at the last minute, I just thought I'll use my own name. And this book happened now because an editor called me and said, why don't we do a collection of your stuff? And, you know, I would never suggest to do something like this
and
myself.
And you never refuse an editor.
I refuse an editor.
This book is dominated by your work for The New Yorker and New Yorker covers, New Yorker illustrations, although there's other material too. Tell me about your first cover for The New Yorker. I think it was in 1993.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, I mean, obviously, your first one you remember. I remember Françoise had been encouraging me to, I had been doing interior drawings for her. For first for Chris Curry and then for Françoise as well.
That's Françoise Mouly, who's the New Yorker's cover editor.
Right. And she encouraged me to send sketches for cover ideas, which I didn't think was my thing. I was doing mostly small drawings. And so what I would do then, this was before I was getting asked to do topical political stuff, I would walk around New York City, which I was new to, and I would scribble. You know, I'd see a hot dog vendor. Oh, that's a great idea. That's so New York. Or a cab driver. And I remember seeing... business people standing outside offices smoking cigarettes because all of a sudden you couldn't smoke in offices anymore. And so that seemed like a good idea, and I put them on window ledges.
So it's a cityscape of people standing on window ledges, and that was your first cover. But now you've become known as a great political artist, you know, like Thomas Nast or Herblock or but yourself. Did you think of yourself as a political person growing up?
Absolutely not. No, that wasn't my thing at all. Well, I mean, I liked hockey and some baseball and then pop music as I got a little older. I had a Dorothy Hamill period where I was drawing her a lot. That ended. But I think, as I wrote in the book, it seemed like when Monica Lewinsky gate happened, when that stuff started, when political news became pop culture news and I was doing regular stuff for Entertainment Weekly and they started asking me to draw Bill Clinton and I was drawing Bill Clinton for The New Yorker as well, it sort of happened from there.
What do you want your political art to do? You've done dozens of covers about George W. Bush. That was a favorite subject for certain, and dozens of covers about Obama, and we'll go into some of the specifics in a second, and now Trump at an even greater rate. Is anybody of all your subjects, of all your political subjects, a favorite, somebody you don't get sick of?
You mean people I draw, subjects?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't get sick of the act of drawing Trump because, I mean, he's an amazing specimen to draw. As I think a lot of presidents are, you know, crazily enough, although he's on another
level.
Well,
describe that for me artistically. Why is he an amazing specimen to draw?
When I'm collecting photo reference, I use photo reference for everything. Some cartoonists don't have to. Whenever I see a photo of someone I want to draw, I'll drag it onto my desktop from wherever it is. And I've just got an enormous file of Trump pictures because it seems like every angle you look at him, there's a new revelation, you see, and a chin you hadn't noticed before, or there's something about the overbite or that the sweep of the hair, you know. It just seems like he's made out of plastic or something. He's just very interesting to draw. And you wonder if his face is his destiny, or it, you know, if there could be a decent person inside of that head, you know?
What do you see in his face?
I mean, I look at a lot of pictures of him and Trump. Sometimes I try and, like, play a game with myself and suppose that this is a great man here. This is a kind, you know, moral, you know, intelligent man. And sometimes I can almost do it, you know? I can see humanity in his face sometimes. But, you know, he keeps proving me wrong.
Barry, my recollection is that during the Bush administration, you did many, many covers about Bush. I don't remember us ever getting any, people would moan or send a note and think we'd gone too far or whatever, but nothing terrible and certainly nothing from the Bush administration. Along comes Barack Obama and he's running for president, and it is in the interim between, as I recall, it was the summer, it was clear that he was the nominee, the Democratic nominee. And he was being called not a patriot, that his wife was somehow a kind of terrorist, that he was born in a foreign land, that he was a Muslim, as if there was something wrong with that. And you decide to do what?
I remember sketching in my sketchbook and thinking, I think it was after Fox called, when Obama and Michelle... They've done a fist bump, and they called it a terrorist fist bump on Fox. And I just thought, wouldn't it be funny to draw everything that they're saying and put it in one picture? And so that's what I did. They were saying that there was a video of Michelle saying "kill Whitey" that, of course, never materialized. So I drew her as sort of an Angela Davis-style militant Black Panther, and I drew Barack as what they were whispering about him. And I stuck a burning American flag in the fireplace just to...
And a portrait of Osama bin Laden,
right,
above the fireplace.
Right, just to telegraph that this is, you know, this is satire, this is not real.
And how did you experience the reaction sitting in Connecticut?
The reaction was harsh, and it was immediate. I mean, it was Sunday night before the magazine came out, but I guess it's leaked to the press on Sunday. And so I think the Huffington Post called me and... a Sunday evening and asked if I regretted it. And I didn't even know it was out yet. And I think I answered glibly. But, you know, by the next day, I learned how many emails it takes to fill up an AOL inbox. It's 1,000 because it went to 1,000 immediately.
Yeah, my email, it looked like a cash register that had broken in a Charlie Chaplin movie or something like that. Dun, 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 kept coming and coming and coming. And the biggest sentiment, it was people on the Democratic side saying, "Of course I understand it." This was the main line of logic. "Of course I get it, but those people out there," meaning in the big square states, the big red states and so on, "they're going to take it as confirmation of everything that Fox is telling them." When you look back on it now, do you think of it as a triumph or a mistake or something in between?
As far as the cartoon of itself, I think of as an experiment. I tried something. I'm not sure it worked. I mean, if it has to be explained to people, I'm not sure it's a... You know, it's a resounding success. I'm fond of the cartoon now. I know that I lost a bar mitzvah gig because of it. I have a little band of illustrators, and that was one of the first reactions to it. Was I got a call from a lady in Katona who had hired me to play music at her.
She dumped the band.
Yeah.
What's the band? I didn't know this.
It's better you don't know.
I want to know.
I shouldn't have brought it up.
I want to know. What do you play?
I play a little piano.
You play a little piano? What kind of songs does the band play?
We play some jazz and some blues and some rock and stuff.
But did it change your did it make you any more nervous? Did you lose your nerve for a bit after that experience?
Not work-wise, really. I mean, I was nervous at home. And
in a physical way?
Sure, yeah.
Like someone would burst through and hurt you?
No, I just meant nervous as in, you know, walking around with a stomach ache. Nervous.
For how long?
How long? A couple of days. A few days. I think until Jon Stewart came on and, you know, he said, you know, come on, everyone, this is a cartoon, you know. And the reaction out there seemed to change after that, too.
I got to say, I'm forever grateful to him.
Yeah.
Now, you know, New Yorker covers have had different phases. In the early Jazz Age era, there were these kind of jazzy, highly colorful, vivid colors. By the 50s, 60s, and certainly into the 70s, William Shawn, who was editor for a long, long time, quieted them down. There would often be covers of the New Yorker that were bowls of fruit or abandoned summer houses or just a line of laundry, just one single sheet hanging out in a kind of Cape Cod September. It was a calming strategy almost. And then other things happened. Do you look back on those eras and see anything that you miss? We got criticized recently in Slate that our covers are too, quote-unquote, thirsty.
I'm a little thirsty right now.
That they're kind of grasping for attention rather than, you know, having this old notion of beauty.
I can't really relate to that personally. I mean, I like a little punch. I mean, it's nice to have a punch and have it in sort of a velvet glove. Is that an actual metaphor?
It could be.
That's something Trump would say he invented. but I mean, it's nice to have an image that is sort of quiet in itself, but is jabbing someone.
Philip Roth once said that reality, American reality, has a way of just outrunning art and any attempt to create purely from the imagination. Just too, the American life is too bizarre. When do you finally say, you know what, this might make a funny drawing, but it's just, I can't. I just can't do it.
It's happening now. I mean, as much as I mentioned that I enjoyed drawing Trump's head and his face and the back of his head, et cetera, it's hard to, I mean, often what you're doing when you're creating a cartoon of someone like that is saying, imagine if he did this. Often he'll go farther than that in reality, and it's hard to – it's not funny anymore. But it seems to be harder and harder to dream up ridiculous scenarios because they're not so ridiculous. You know, they can happen.
They happen every day.
They happen every day. And, I mean, the Harvey Weinstein thing seemed like it was something to make fun of. But since then, I mean, there's been a lot of names added to that, you know, that particular docket, and that's hard to make fun of, too. So it feels like the walls are closing in on us.
Sounds like we could both use a week off.
Yeah.
Barry Blitt, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Barry Blitt's new book is called Blitt, the Book.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.